Hell Yes Life, episode 37. Welcome to the Hell Yes Life podcast, the show that helps you come alive so you can live a hell yes life. I'm your host, Norman Bell. Hey there, Hell Yes Lifers. Welcome to another episode of the Hell Yes Life podcast. I am your host, Norman Bell. This is the place to hear inspiring stories and actionable tips from our amazing guests that will motivate you to live your Hell Yes Life. The Hell Yes Life podcast releases episodes every Tuesday and now with increasing frequency on Thursdays and Fridays. A couple of quick announcements. The first is this. I am looking for a few awesome Hell Yes Lifers who want to form a free online mastermind group for 3 months, likely starting in September. In the group, we will be looking to identify our Hell Yeses, clarify our cringeworthy visions, set up our Hell Yes days for maximum productivity, and take massive action towards living our Hell Yes lives. If you are interested in participating, please visit hellyeslife.com/mastermind to answer a few questions about why you think you'd be a good candidate for the group. All right, let's get into today's episode. Today, my guest is Jeff Raceley. Jeff is an avid outdoorsman and recreational athlete who has trekked or climbed in the India-Nepal Himalayas almost every year since 1995. He's the author of 9 books, including India, Nepal, Himalayas in the Moment, and Bringing Progress to Paradise, What I Got from Giving to a Mountain Village in Nepal. Jeff is president of the Basa Village Foundation, which funds culturally sensitive development in Nepal. He is also U.S. liaison for the Himalayan expedition company Adventure Geotreks Limited. In our conversation, we mainly talk about his experiences in Nepal, but Jeff is a man of many interests. He is a director of 5 nonprofits. He teaches about the philosophy of philanthropy at Butler University in Indiana. He has scuba dived throughout the Caribbean, sea kayaked in Palau, Tonga, and the Greek Isles. He also loves to read and considers completing Marcel Proust's 3,600-page remembrance of things past as great of an adventure as climbing Himalayan peaks. Jeff is an amazing guy, and I know you're going to enjoy our conversation, so let's dive in. Jeff Raceley, welcome to the Hell Yes Life podcast. Are you ready to tell us about your Hell Yes Life?
Thanks, Norman. Hell yes, I'm ready.
All right. Thanks, Jeff. Thanks for being here. I'm really excited to talk to you about what your big interest is, because Nepal is a place that I feel Nepal calling. So I can't wait to dive in and talk about it. But I always like to ask my guests, right out of the gate, what is your hell yes? And by that, I mean, what is your passion, that thing that really makes you come alive?
Yeah. Well, you know, I'm probably a full generation older than you, Norman. So what used to make me come alive was the traveling and adventuring, which has been a huge part of my life. And now it's more writing about it. So, you know, when I feel the most passionate now, and, you know, I come away from doing something where I say, yeah, you know, man, hell yeah, that just feels good. It's now more the writing about the adventures I've had than the setting off on another adventure.
Well, that's great. That's great. So you've had lots of great adventures, and you're doing the world a service by now documenting those and sharing them with us. So that is awesome. So let's back up. Like, where did, and now let me ask you this, is I know everything I've read about you or heard about you so far has to do with Nepal. Is that really the main focus of your adventure travels, or have you traveled to numerous places around the world?
It's been a major focus. I've been to over 40 countries. I lost count at 40. And I've had, you know, really kind of different foci at different times. Like when I was younger, motorcycle tripping was something I loved and looked forward to. Scuba diving was another one. Solo kayaking, solo sea kayaking, kayaking from island to island was another. So, you know, I've been kind of passionate about each of those sorts of adventure travel, but I've been to Nepal 13 times and climbed and trekked over a bunch of mountains in the Himalayas and have, you know, probably devoted more time, energy, and money to that than any of the other adventure travel passions I've had.
Oh boy, oh boy. I can't wait to dive in and talk about that. I want to back all the way up though first and ask, can you remember where did this come from, this interest in adventure travel? Does it go all the way back to when you were a kid, or does anything come to mind when I ask that?
Yeah, I think it goes back to being a kid with a lot of curiosity growing up in a small town, which was a very homogeneous culture. And my family generally once a year would take a driving trip down to Florida. And one time we drove out to California and back, and I grew up in a town in northern Indiana. But so those driving trips all the way south to Florida and all the way west to California were just, I loved them. I just loved seeing the country, meeting different people. And so it created, I think, a spark of interest in me that I really wasn't able to actualize until I hit the age of 18. And then I went to the edge of town, stuck my thumb out, and hitchhiked across the country.
Oh, you know, I think I heard a little bit of this story on Brittany Felix's podcast. I was listening to her interview with you, and Hell Yes Lifers. Brittany has a great podcast, the Living Unconventionally podcast. She is also going to be a guest on the show soon here too. Jeff, can you tell us a little bit about that story? So you stuck your thumb out?
Yeah. In fact, Brittany and I were supposed to mainly talk about Nepal, and she got so interested in a couple of my earlier adventures that we had to do a second show to finally get around to Nepal. So be careful here.
Okay.
But yeah. So I had I started college, went for a semester. And really was just tired of going to school. I mean, you know, I'd gone to school my entire life. So I quit school with the intention of working long enough just to raise enough money that I could hit the road. So I got a job in this factory, which was a truly horrible job. It was like one of those 19th century smokestack, awful places, dark, dingy, dirty. And I ran a punch press machine, was lucky not to lose any fingers, but I saved up $65. Now, this is in 1972, and I hitchhiked for 6 weeks and came home with $5 in my pocket.
Awesome. Awesome. So, and so that was your kind of your first trip out of town there. You're right. I don't want to go too far down the road of, your hitchhiking journeys there, but, you know, just briefly what happened during that trip?
Well, I met the first gay person I'd ever known, at least known they were gay, because I got picked up several times by homosexual guys who were hoping for more than just giving a tall, handsome young man a ride. But that's all they ended up getting out of it, which was very interesting to me. I mean, you know, growing up as I did, like I said, it was a very homogeneous culture. And so meeting gay people for the first time was interesting. But I went down to the University of Miami. Miami. And back then, you could just kind of hang out on college campuses, and people would give you a place to sleep, and you could sneak into the cafeteria and eat food for free. And eventually ran into some guys from Chicago that were going to fly over to Jamaica to try to do some drug dealing. And they had this old Maverick automobile, I think it was a Ford Maverick. And they said, well, hey, since you're from Northern Indiana, how about you take our car, go wherever you want to go, but eventually drive it up to back to Chicago for us. So I said, hey, that's cool. So I loaded up my car or their car with a bunch of other people. Six of us headed over to New Orleans to go to Mardi Gras. And the clutch burned out in the car because it was a manual. About 100 miles outside of New Orleans, and we drove the rest of the way in second gear, limping along about 25 miles per hour, but we made it, got into New Orleans. The other five people in the car jumped out and lit out on their own, left me with this car that wasn't working so well, so I drove it on to Tulane University campus, found a campus cop, said, I'm going to abandon this car here, and here's the registration, and this is who owns it, and I'll call them and tell them where it is, but, you know, sorry, do whatever you need to do with an abandoned car. So I called the guy, and he said, well, we flew to Jamaica, we got off the airport, and they got off the airplane. They wouldn't leave us. They would not let us leave the airport. So basically, they landed, got kicked out of the country, flew back to Miami, then flew back to Chicago, and were waiting for their car. So I said, well, you better call Tulane Security. And so I hung out in New Orleans for about a week and a half, enjoyed my first Mardi Gras, which was crazy, and then hitchhiked home.
That's a great first adventure. And it's funny because there's some things in there that maybe other people in the same situation, but with a different frame of mind, might have thought, oh, geez, I'm never doing that again. You know, like all these people I met along the way and all these misadventures that happened, I'm staying put. But no, that just gave you a taste for more, right? And I feel the same way. I've had some pretty wacky misadventures in my past too, and it just gave me a taste for more. Yeah,
it did. I mean, I've had so many experiences where when they're happening, I'm thinking, oh my God, how did I get myself into this? And how am I going to get myself out of this? And then you live through it and it's like, wow, wasn't that cool? That's a great. My wife kids me because every time I come home from a mountaineering adventure in Nepal, I get home and I say, I'm never going to do that again. It's like, it took too much out of me. I thought I was going to die. And she said, because in about 2 weeks, you'll be bragging about how that was the coolest thing you've ever done. And damn it, she's right.
That is great. Okay, so let's go ahead and jump forward to Nepal then. So tell me about the first time you got the kind of the hankering to head to Nepal.
Well, it's my wife's fault. I turned 40 and was manifesting what she diagnosed as midlife crisis symptoms. And I came home from the office one day. I was an attorney. I'm a retired attorney now, but was the senior partner in a small law firm, a lot of responsibilities. Two young boys, very involved father. Life was just, you know, stretched. A lot of stress. And so came home one day, she slapped down on the table in front of me a brochure about trekking in Nepal. And she said, why don't you go do this? So she was basically saying, hey, buddy, go take a hike and do it on the other side of the world. And it was great. You know, it was a great diagnosis, because what she realized is how much I loved adventure travel, and I hadn't done it for several years, and she could see that my soul needed it. Mm-hmm. And so she said, you know, go do it. The boys will be here. I'll be here. My office manager, secretary, younger partner assured me the law firm would be there. In fact, it turned out they made more money while I was gone. And so a friend of mine, I told him I was going to do this. He said, can I come with you? I said, sure. So two of us flew from Indianapolis to Kathmandu, and we joined a trekking group, hiked the Mount Everest Base Camp Trail. And then we had a really great adventure on the way home, because he had a good buddy he hadn't seen who lived in Indonesia. So we stopped in Jakarta, spent some time there, went to Bali, spent a week on exploring Bali, and then came home. So wonderful adventure. And just being up in the Himalayas turned me on to mountains. I mean, in the Midwest, we don't have mountains. I mean, we barely have hills. And so experiencing the highest mountains in the world was a turn on. But even more than that, what affected me was the Sherpa people and the Sherpa culture. Sir Edmund Hillary described them as the strongest and the kindest people in the world. And I found that to be true, and was really became fascinated with their culture, and also kind of just with their psychology. Like, how can you small people who are so much smaller than I am be so tough and strong, and also be so sweet and kind? Yeah. So, mm-hmm. You know, that's what I came home with, this love of the mountains and love of the people.
Okay, great. So I'm going to back us up a little bit, because, you know, this is one of my dreams, is to do what you just said right there. I have it in mind about doing the Annapurna trek, versus the Everest Base Camp, but maybe you can advise me on that. Take us there. Okay. So take us. So you're coming in, whether it's the first time you went or you've been multiple times now. I mean, can you just give us a sense of, you know, what is life there like? So you come in from the airport, and you probably go into Kathmandu. Take us there. I hear it's very noisy and so forth. And then take us out to the trails.
Driving from the airport to Tamil, which is where almost all the tourists stay. And interestingly, even though the tourists stay there, it's the old town. It's the oldest part of Kathmandu. And it's a fascinating place with these little winding streets. But there's motels all through there, and restaurants and shops and so forth. But the drive from the airport to your hotel in Tamil is incredible. It's a culture shock. Some people actually go into culture shock who really aren't prepared for it. One guy who was in one of my trekking groups told me, sitting beside him on the airplane flying from Indianapolis to Kathmandu, is a Nepali guy. And the advice the Nepali guy gave him, which I've cherished since then, was just open your mind, expect the unexpected. When you drive across Kathmandu, you'll see animals walking in the street, these little tuk-tuk scooter contraptions, motorcycles, bicycles, people riding donkeys, luxury limos. Just the traffic itself is this amazing blend of the ancient and the modern, and everything you see is like that. The women wear these beautiful, colorful saris, and I mean, the dress is so colorful. And colors are everywhere and smells. Everything is out in the open. Shops are just open, and vendors are on the sidewalks, out in the street. People live much more openly. You'll see barbers shaving and cutting hair on the sidewalk, women washing clothes. So it's just life is so much more vivid. The smells, the sounds, everything is so much more powerful and direct than what we're used to. The air pollution is a problem. They don't have, most of their vehicles don't have catalytic converters. If they have any kind of exhaust system, you know, they're lucky. And so sometimes the air is pretty noxious with carbon monoxide. But other than that, it's a beautiful, amazing experience. And so usually you'll spend a couple days and nights in Kathmandu, which is at 5,000 feet. And so if you're a lowlander like me, that's really the start of your acclimatization. And then typically you'll fly up into the mountains. There are several mountain airports. There's, you know, a dropping off spot for all the major trails. And then you'll start your trek from the airport. Now, some, like if you're going to Basa Village, we can fly up near it, or we can drive. It's kind of drive to the end of the road and start the trek there. And that, which is also true of another not that Basa Village is a popular trekking place. It's not. But another popular trekking place you can drive to is called Langtang, which is a beautiful area. But Annapurna or base camp, you're going to fly and then start your trek from there.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Okay, and so then, great job. Thanks for kind of really painting that picture of Kathmandu and the sights and smells. Now take us out on the trail. So we're either on Annapurna or headed to base camp. What's it like there? I mean, like, you know, everything from acclimatizing to just, are you surrounded by these gorgeous peaks at every turn?
Yeah, you are, especially... Now, I have to admit, I've never done the Annapurna circuit. I've organized several groups that have, but I've just been so taken up with these three other areas to the north that I've never gotten there. But really, no matter where you are, what you're going to experience is there are two basic differences in approach to trekking. One we call a tea house trek or a lodge trek, and the other is a tent trek, which is the traditional British aristocratic way of trekking, you know, that was started back in the 1920s by Mallory and then Hillary and so forth. All the, you know, the legendary mountaineers did what is still done as tent trekking. And if you do a tent trek, you'll have porters that carry all the heavy stuff, the tent, the cooking gear. You'll have a cook, and you'll have a sirdar, which is head guide. And you'll the sirdar will have a schedule and a plan so that where he's already, you know, scoped out where you're going to stop for lunch, where you're going to stop for dinner, and where you're going to camp. And then in between those stops, you go at your own pace. So, you know, you might be ahead of the porters, you might be behind the porters, you might walk with the guide or other people, or you might walk by yourself. I mean, it's completely up to you. And the same is true of the tea house trek. The difference on the tea house trek is you're not going to be sleeping in a tent, and you're not going to have your own cook. So you're going to be stopping at lodges for all your meals, and you're going to sleep in the lodges. Now, 10, 15, 20 years ago, most of the lodges were very Spartan. And by that, I mean your particular room would have plywood walls, which if you got up and stumbled during the night and fell into one, it would probably break. So you'd find yourself in somebody else's room because you just broke through their wall. There mostly were no indoor toilets. All of that's changed on the Annapurna Circuit and the Base Camp Trail, and some of the other secondary trails now have lodges that indoor plumbing, running water, hot showers, fairly comfortable bed, kind of on the level of a Motel 6, sort of like a moderate to low-end highway motel, which to over there up in the mountains, it's incredible luxury. So, you know, that's kind of, you know, the choice you need to make as far as what sort of experience you want to have. And there's advantages to each. Like the wonderful thing about the lodge trek is every evening you're going to have dinner with people from all over the world. I mean, trekkers from every country. You have these amazing, wonderful dinner time conversations. I mean, people might start singing. There's usually a musician in the group. Somebody maybe will play. I mean, it's a delightful cultural event. Then on the tent trek, you're going to be with your group. Now, sometimes if you're at a campsite where there's other groups, you know, you can hang out with other trekkers and get together. But generally, you're going to have your meal in a meal tent or depending on the weather around a campfire, but typically in a meal tent, and you're going to be with your group. So if you like your group, you get to be very close, intimate, because you're sharing all sorts of things, some things you don't particularly want to share, like bodily fluids that come out because you have diarrhea or something like that. But yeah, so anyway, you know, those are the basic differences.
That's great. And so let's see. So take us to, you've been there 13 times. So that there's, and you're, I think I've read that you have a trip planned for, this coming, October, November. Is that right? So this, I've looked into this a little bit myself. So the best kind of trekking season is around that time of year. Is it October, November?
Yeah. The two most popular months, are traditionally October and May. And springtime has become a little problematic, and, you know, it may be due to climate change, but it seems like the monsoon is starting earlier than it used to. And so it used to be, you know, May was a great month to be there up in the mountains. It would probably be a little, you know, maybe a few more chances of rain than in October, but on a typical 2 to 3 week trek or climb in May, you might have 3-4 days of rain, or if you're up high, snow. In October, you know, maybe 1 or 2. And now it's gotten so it's, you might find yourself in the monsoon. Like the last time I was there in 2013, we went over in late April and into May, and the monsoon started in April, and it rained every day. And then when we were up higher, it snowed every day. So in the fall, what I discovered over time is that November, to me, is preferable than October, because everything is pretty much the same, except the vast majority of trekkers and tourists are gone. And so, you know, if you enjoy sort of a more pristine experience, November is actually a better month. You won't have as many of the really interesting cross-cultural experiences with like Swiss climbers and Germans and Italians and the English and, you know, and Japanese and Taiwanese and Aussies, you know, Kiwis, people from all over the world, because there just aren't so many people up there then. So that's, you know, that's another consideration. But flights in and out of Kathmandu are easier to get that time of the year. Flights up into and out of the mountains are also your, you know, sometimes in the really the peak trekking season, you might discover that that flight up or that flight out you were counting on, it's not going to happen. And that's
right.
Things can get pretty wacky when that happens, because, you know, choices then start having to be made in terms of changing your itinerary.
And what about the trails themselves? Are they kind of crowded during that time? Like you're not in like a long line of people, are you? Or could it get to that extent?
Yeah, it can get to that extent. There are certain choke points on the Annapurna Circuit and Base Camp Trail, which are typically bridges. So you're going to cross a river or a big stream, and you have a yak train, I mean, local yak herders who are just moving their animals, the big climbing, especially in the Base Camp Trail, big climbing expeditions moving all their gear in these big 50-pound barrels on yaks, plus just lots of porters either moving goods from one village to another, and portering for the expeditions and all the trekkers. You get to a bridge, and there may be 100 people, you know, waiting. And some of these bridges are really narrow. I mean, they're suspension bridges. And it's on some of them, you really, they're kind of one way. And there's just an ethic of courtesy that most people seem to obey. After so many have gone across one way, then people from the other way go. And it works out. But that, and sometimes, you know, that's pretty interesting. I mean, it's a great time for picture taking, because the bridges are, you know, often over these huge gorges. And also, you know, time to talk to strangers. But on the other hand, if, you know, you want to be moving at your own pace, it's kind of a pain in the ass to be stuck there. I mean, you don't think of, you know, I'm up in the mountains. You're not supposed to have a traffic jam up here, but it can happen.
Yeah, a yak traffic jam. Yeah, kind of a specific kind of a traffic jam there. So, well, that's good. Good. So, you know, maybe there's some listeners out there who are, you know, considering a trip to Nepal. There's some great information to help you decide when and where to go. Let me ask you a little bit about, is it called the Basu Village? Is that right?
Basa.
Basa. Okay, the Basa Village Project. Can you tell us a little bit about your involvement with that?
Yeah, how it got started was I had been organizing trekking groups and mountaineering expeditions for a few years myself, and I came across the one trekking company that I'd been doing. We ran into some communication problems, and so I started looking at other companies and came across this one called Adventure GeoTreks, communicated with Niru, the owner of the company, by email, and we really hit it off, and they had great recommendations, but had really not had any American customers. Organized a group and used Adventure GeoTreks as our outfitter company. Had a wonderful experience. I mean, the guys that Niru hired were mostly from his home village, which is Basa Village. And so our porters, cook, guides were all from Basa. And I got to know these guys and had a wonderful time with them. They're not Sherpa. They're of a different tribe called the Rai. Just great experience. We did the Base Camp Trail and were planning on climbing a mountain called Lobache East, ended up not climbing that mountain. And in fact, the guys in our climbing group, except for me, had all decided that just the trek was enough for them. And they decided they didn't want to climb a mountain. But so the guide and I went off, and we just, what we called pirated or poached a peak that we weren't licensed to do. But I got to know him really well from that experience. And then back in Kathmandu, talking with Nehru, he told me that the village, Bassa, had a little school with three grades, and they wanted to add a fourth and a fifth grade. And would I consider raising $5,000 from American friends and donating that for the school, because if we did that, they could buy all the materials to add two classrooms, and they could pay two more teacher salaries for 3 years. And so I did. So raised the money, and then went back the next year and trekked to Bassa. Had possibly the most amazing and crazy experience I'd had in Nepal up to that point. Really fell in love with the village and the villagers, and decided I wanted to maintain a relationship. And so Nehru and I eventually organized sister foundations, with his in Kathmandu and mine based in the States. And it's grown so that we have a board of, I think there's eight of us on the board now here, and 30-some members of the foundation. And we've supported water projects, electrical projects, computer, just a number of projects to raise the standard of living in Bassa. And then 2 years ago, earthquakes hit, and Bassa, like so many of the villages in Nepal, were severely damaged. So the last 2 years, we raised money, and the villagers rebuilt the village and the school. And so we're going back this fall, partly just to celebrate the rebuilding of the village, but also to do some trekking and climbing. And I coined a term some years ago called philanthro-trekking, which is what I've more and more devoted myself to, which is a combination of doing philanthropy with trekking. And so, like in this case, some of the people in our group are members of the foundation, others are not. They'll be, introduced to what we've done, but there's no pressure to join the foundation or give to the foundation. It'll be a cultural introduction to life in Nepal, both in Kathmandu and up in the mountains. And then if people want to get involved in the work of the foundation, that's great. And if they don't, that's no problem either. And it also supports Bassa indirectly, because Nehru's company, Adventure Geotreks, is the only outside employer for the villagers. Some leave the village to go work in Kathmandu and other places, but basically there's no commerce in villages like this. All the villages are basically subsistence farmers. Because the economic changes in their world, it's really helpful for them to have an outside income in addition to their farming. And so Nehru employs a bunch of the men and some of the women, and then that brings money into the village just by virtue of us, hiring them to take us on a trek.
That's great. That's great. I like how you found sort of a very specific place in Nepal that you can kind of focus your efforts on, and your, you know, your philanthropy and service. So that's awesome. And, you know, at the end of the show, we'll get where we can find you on the internet, and we'll have links in the show notes. So if there's anything specific that you want to include about this project and, you know, for people who might be interested, you know, we'll make sure and get that in there. I wanted to ask, maybe turning as we start to wind down here, turning towards the future. I think you sound like you're just living a hell yes life here. You've been going to Nepal. You're writing about this now. You've had all kinds of amazing adventures. But I always ask our guests, you know, do you have any big vision for the future? And I call this your cringeworthy vision, a vision so big that you cringe just to think about sharing it with other people. Do you have any vision like that? Or are you pretty happy with how things are going?
I'm almost too happy with life. Like I said, you know, I'm a generation older than you, and have already lived out all the big adventures I wanted to do, I've done. I'm not quitting adventuring, obviously, going back to Nepal, going to try to climb a 22,000-foot mountain while I'm there. But, you know, what I enjoy writing, talking. I mean, life is sort of... in some ways, more normal than it was when I was doing a lot of adventuring. But in 2 weeks, my wife and I are going to Italy to travel around Tuscany for a few weeks, going up to Canada in July. Cultural thing mostly, go to the Shakespeare Festival, but also do some hiking. And so, you know, I mean, I'm very active in that sense. But, if there's something I want to do, I do it.
Yeah. That's great. So you're already living your cringeworthy vision. It's awesome. So, let me just ask this just for any of our listeners out there who might be, let's say earlier in their journey, or maybe they haven't taken that step yet. Maybe they're back working at the law firm or wherever they're working, and they have these dreams of Nepal or wherever in the world. Do you have any, advice or thoughts for someone like that who might be listening? Taking that first step?
Yeah, I do. And it really goes back to what that Nepali guy told my friend, which is, be curious. That's kind of the fundamental motivation for doing adventure type traveling. But then be open-minded. Don't have this preconception of how everything is supposed to be and, you know, get upset if things don't go just how you wanted them. I mean, the most amazing experiences I've had are when things have gone wrong. And it's, you know, you're feeling like it's not hell yes, it's hell no, it's happening. But then, you know, you find a way to get through it. And that is what is so cool, is to have had something that was completely unexpected. I mean, whether it's meeting people you didn't expect to meet or finding yourself in a place that offered some challenge you had no idea you could handle, those are the ones that you treasure in memories more than the ones where, oh, it all went just perfectly. And then the other thing I have, you know, more and more come to value is to not just go someplace and, you know, take away from it. But if you can, leave something in the sense of not, you know, leaving an ugly footprint of trash and that thing, but leave something in terms of your own love of the place. Find a charity that helps the local people. I mean, the thing is, you know, we are well off Americans and Europeans, and we go to these other places, and almost everybody we meet over there has less than we do. And they, you know, you go and you have a great experience and you're treated well by the locals, and You know, so why not find a way to give to them? Now, you know, some people, you know, diss tourism, and there are certainly some problems with some type of tourism. But the reality is, so many places in the world, tourism is a wonderful thing for the local people, because it's at least one way to make a living. And so that's a good thing that we do. But it's an even better thing that if we can find a way to help the local people sustain a local economy beyond when we leave.
Right, right. Yeah, it's really the how as opposed to the what, right? Of course, traveling is one of my big hell yeses, and I know that there are areas in the world that are overly touristed, but if you can, you know, travel in a thoughtful way, a mindful way, then I think it's beneficial to all, for sure. Jeff, thanks so much for joining us and sharing those. You know, I have an even better picture in my mind of what I'm going to say, what that Nepal trip that I'm going to take is going to be like. And hopefully you've inspired some of our listeners to take a trip, whether it be to Nepal or somewhere else, and have a great adventure. To close out our time, I always like to say hell yes together on the count of three. Whether you think it's a little corny or not, let's go ahead and give it a go. Are you ready to do that?
I can handle it, Norman.
Okay, let's do it. Okay, one, two, three.
Hell yes. You were more practiced at that than me.
Oh, yeah. Well, hey, it's my show, so that's fair enough. But thanks a lot, Jeff. We appreciate you coming to join us.
Thank you, Norman. I really enjoyed this talk.
Thanks for joining me for this episode of the Hell Yes Life podcast. You can subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or your favorite RSS feed. If you like the show, please leave a rating and review. And if you want to stay connected, visit hellyeslife.com and sign up for the e-newsletter and private Facebook group. Again, I'm Norman Bell. Thanks for joining me. Now let's get out there and live a Hell Yes Life.